You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast. Hello there and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith and this is Sean Hughes in another show recorded live at the Gilded Balloon at last year's Edinburgh Fringe. We've only got about five of these shows left now after this one. There's some great episodes coming up with Tim Vine and David O'Doherty, Claudia O'Doherty, Max Sinavan and Ed Byrne. So stick around for them in the next few weeks. But now, here's Sean Hughes.
Hi, Sean.
Hi, everyone. Thanks very much for coming, Sean.
My pleasure.
So, let's do it. Yeah, fine. I don't know if we're quite ready to do it.
I'm ready.
So, your show this year, just for anyone here who hasn't seen it or anyone listening on the podcast who didn't make it to the festival, just if you could briefly sketch out what your show was this year.
See, I'm not very good at that. I think it's what you saw. How would you explain it to people?
I could
walk out if you don't.
Good turnaround. Yeah,
this doesn't go well. It could be a short podcast.
Well, I think what your show was a really interesting kind of. I felt like you were wrangling with the subjects of loneliness and being middle aged and being childless. Is that? Do you think that's true?
No, not really.
You were. It was a show about regret.
On the surface. No, it's not actually. It's about the main thrust of the show is about society tells us how to do things, and I'm of an age where I go, no, that's strictly speaking not how you have to live your life. And so the very fact that you bring up the fact that you're alone, my life choices. I'm 47 and I'm not married and I haven't got children, so I'm seen as an oddball. But they're life choices, and I think that's wrong that I'm seen as an oddball for that.
Okay.
So that's pretty much. But it's interesting because you just said, oh, you're childless and you're learning. And I go, no, that's okay.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. But it's about those topics. It covers those topics. And for all that you are seen as an oddball, it's a very odd show. Do you not think?
I don't know.
In comparison, I don't mean that in a negative way at all.
Yeah.
But in comparison to a lot of sort of shiny, flawed, besuited stand-up that you could find at the festival.
Well, there's two big changes to me in the last 4 or 5 years. Is the last two shows, pretty much, I've wanted them to be uplifting rather than be cynical, and just also it's about a connection with an audience. And I think jokes only go so far, so I tend to try and use emotion, which is very hard. And then you're seeing as an odd joke, 'cause you're using real emotion, to try and push across points, and obviously try to do it with humour, but it's kind of like I'm very much of that, and this sounds up to someone else, but it isn't. But as I'm joke as philosophy, you know, that's what I'm going for.
Okay,
if it's successful, that's up to other people, but I have to try and connect with the audience, and because basically the whole show is all about it's all right to be you're not a failure, even though society might deem you to be one.
Sure.
That's what the show's about. It's not about loneliness and not having a child.
Okay.
That's just surface stuff.
Sure. Okay. Well, let's, in order to
it's better than, I kind of, because I always insist that when I do interview people, the only thing I ask is that they come and see the show. And I had to do the Simon Mayo show for Radio 2. And I listened to him on the radio and I thought he was all right. But, God, so bear in mind that he came to see the show, he's still the first question was, so why is it called Penguins? I'm just going, what a shit question to ask considering you just watched me sweat for an hour on stage, you know?
Sure. Do you know that he definitely came?
Yeah, yeah, he did.
Oh, he
yeah.
did come. Yeah. Is that better or worse? I don't know. That's well, true no, than if no, he was on the blag.
It was probably worse because I got the impression he didn't quite get the show.
Sure.
Okay. So that's always a little bit worse when you're talking. So when you're going inside, you're going, you didn't like it, did you?
Well, I hope what this podcast gives us the opportunity to do is to unpick those sorts of things.
Sure.
And how important is to you that there is a central message in the show rather than, you know, a range of emotions being explored?
But this is another thing, and it's new to me as well, but this goes totally against the grain, because comedy is very much punchline, where you're told, like, every joke is a story, but the tiny story is set up punchline. But it is a story, and I wanted to try bring ambiguity into the comedy. Because also, it's very much like, it's coming from being middle-aged and having done lots of hour sets like the young comics now. Mm. And like, I'm not going to knock young comics, but there's so many of those telling jokes. You certainly don't need a middle-aged guy to be thrown into that mix. So I just want to do something slightly different, having moved away slightly from that format.
Sure. Well, let's just, so we can put that in context, let's explore that format and how you came to comedy. Now, obviously, there's lots of material in other interviews and online about how you started in comedy. But if you could just briefly explain that for our audience here, like how you brought yourself to comedy originally.
I was about... I'm just one of those people very driven. So I was about 14 in Dublin, not really expected much of my life. And I saw Richard Pryor on the television. Mm-hmm. I think it was the programme that they showed on BBC Four last night, actually.
Mm-hmm. The Storyville documentary.
The stand-up of him.
Oh, sure. Okay.
Live. And I watched that with my dad, and I just went, that's the only person so far in my life who's actually spoken the truth. Mm-hmm. And I said, I'd like to do that. And I think you find all the really good comics, they want to be someone like Richard Pryor. They feel, because he's got such a gift that you feel, he makes it look so easy that he's just talking about shit. And you go, oh, go out and do that on stage. And I remember desperately wanting to be Richard Pryor, but didn't have any of the skill set. So I ended up being in a double act doing Star Trek material, because that's as good as I was.
Okay.
That's all I could do.
Sure.
And I desperately... Like, it took me about 10 years before I could find any kind of voice where I could do things that looked like naturally talking, but it just takes so much space on stage to become that good.
Because presumably part of it is when you first start out, you're so desperate to get any kind of a laugh that you do anything in order to get it. I mean, when you were doing Star Trek material in a double act, because I think a lot of people that listen to this show, a lot of comics and maybe creative people in the audience today, will kind of empathize with that thing of like, well, I had this goal in my mind, but actually if I look back at some of the stuff I did...
This is the weird thing, because I did things in school and stuff, and that was like just whatever jokes happened to be on the telly, and we did them. Like, there wasn't any writing. And then I did a media course with some guys, and we started a double act. And it was one of those where we went to the TV station, RTE, the Irish TV station, for the day, on like a day trip, you know, with our sandwiches. And me and my mate impressed one of the producers, and they said, oh, do you want to... So pretty much when I was 19, I did live television as a double act. And
that
was amazing. Like, we were fucking proper shit. And we were on television. Like,
what was it called? What were you called as a double act?
Exactly. We were called the Short and Curlies.
Okay, yep.
So we were so bad, but it was just amazing. Like, you know, like really thrown in at the deep end. So we did a double act, and then... We did that, and then there was no structure for doing comedy in Dublin, so we started supporting bands.
Okay.
And so it became fairly obvious stuff, because you can't do any subtlety in a rock gig.
Sure,
you know?
Sure.
And then we came over to London as a double act to do, you know, to start, you know, break it in London. And the first couple of gigs we did, they went really, really well. And then about four gigs in, we died on our ass. Mm-hmm. And my mate, Short or Curly, I don't know which one he was, he just said, I remember we were living in a flat in Walthamstow above a hairdresser's, like really living the dream. And I think it was a unisex though, so it was nice. And I remember him, he didn't say anything, but obviously it really affected him, us dying on stage.
Yeah.
And what I loved about being in a double act is it was you two against the world rather than just you.
Sure.
And that was so important. But he just says, he made up this call and said, oh, my sister's really ill, I'm just going to go back and visit her. And I knew. That's what he said, but he was pretty much saying to me, I am never doing comedy ever again. And we had about 12 gigs booked, which I went on and did as a solo performer, cobbled together, like, you know, the Star Trek stuff as a one man piece. Sure. And I just learned how to improvise on stage then. So that was okay. By luck and judgment that I kind of learned how to really deal with shit on stage, because I had no material and I had the gigs to do.
So the first time you went on as a stand-up, what was written was a combination of cobbled together half a double act and presumably like stuff you thought on the bus on the way there of like, I'll throw everything together.
If we could only afford a bus back then. But yeah, pretty much.
Sure.
But it made me work really, really hard.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so how was that experience of those first few gigs on your own? Was that a positive experience or was it something you just felt you got away with?
I'd say I got away with it more than anything else. But this is the thing, when I started doing comedy, it was seen as an art form, and it was also, bizarrely, it's totally turned on its head. It was seen as something that you don't get good at until you hit your 50s. Because it was saying, well, what life experience have you got? And I became part of that generation with Newman and Badil, who became Comedy's New Rock and Roll. Mm-hmm. So we kind of started that a little bit. But and now, you know, it's all about young people. Like, you know, if you're after 24, you're seeing, you know, what the hell do you want to listen to you for? Bring another fella back on. So it was...
That's seen by that, I think, do you mean by producers or by audiences?
By everybody. Like, comedy wasn't a young... Because comedy wasn't on... Stand-up wasn't on television. So but you have to bear in mind... People on the alternative circuit weren't looking for a break onto television. They wanted to express themselves. Mm. And that's why it was a beautiful, absolutely beautiful scene. And like, it wasn't we were all being left wing and all that, but it was just a collective of people who wanted to express whatever it was. You know, mine happened to be shitty Star Trek jokes at the time, but you know, this was a massive freedom for everyone. And then television, like then that's when the Friday and the Saturday Night Live came out with Ben Elton. And we all, that was the thing then. It was... we all got like 5 minute slots on that. And weirdly, I'm rubbish over 5 minutes. Like there's certain comics that are brilliant over it and I never was. So I hated all that.
Okay.
But it was, so we were just doing it to express. And then, well, actually I'm probably jumping ahead. I'll have done my whole career in four minutes.
That's all right. Well, let's just focus in on this idea of self-expression. And how much of when you were a young guy doing the Star Trek stuff or whatever you could put together, did you have ideas about self-expression then, or was in terms of the material, or was it simply the fact that you were doing comedy felt you were expressing yourself?
I think it was a bit of both, and then I just felt at the time it was very much just above pubs with the gigs, so you were given a lot more space to make mistakes, which you're not now. Because then like, basically your day was you'd get a notebook like you have there and you'd just write some stuff and you'd go out and you'd try them.
Were you quite a busy writer? Were you kind of waking up in the morning and writing stuff?
No, I've never been a 9-to-5 writer. I always wait for it to come to me. And even to this day, I still do most of my writing on stage. Mm-hmm. But it's... I was kind of doing kind of one-liners at the time. And it's it didn't really... Because I remember one of the lines I used to do, like really corny lines, but I remember doing one at the Comedy Store where I'd go, oh, I hate those come on lines. You know the ones I mean? Like, come on. And you know, which are fine, and you'd sell it in a deadpan way, but I just kind of went, this isn't me, and I couldn't really find my voice. So it was less about writing new material, it was really just trying to articulate your own personality.
Okay. One of the earliest jokes I remember seeing you do, and it must have been on telly years ago, was you talking about drinking and going, oh, that's gone straight to my clothes.
You know, yeah, I don't remember that.
Do you not?
That's loads so I don't remember. Probably drunk, wasn't I?
When I had Norman Lovett on the show here, I reminded him of a joke about a Kit Kat and that I've reminded him of 3 times in the last 10 years. And every time I've reminded him of it, he's gone, oh, I must put that back in. It hasn't stayed with him in that way.
You know, it is weird, because there's lots of, sometimes people remember stuff and I have no recollection of it. It's just that's of a time, and then you know it's like you move on. It's a bit like a relationship. You have that relationship with the jokes, and then you just don't want anything to do with them, really.
And you said you were probably drunk at the time. Were you drinking on stage at that
no,
time?
No, well, no. You drink socially. I've never done a show. I think I've done one show once where I was probably a bit hammered, but I'm mortified. I just think you have to be professional in that situation. You know, I think you know it's a very sociable thing, but you'd have one maybe. Beforehand.
Did that reflect what people were doing around you? Was everyone sort of expressing themselves and sort of was everyone as concerned with the art of it?
No, it was already creeping because I was at the tail end of the political movement, so it was already creeping into just people making a decent living out of being quite lazy, really. But it was kind of it was still, like, as I say, no one was doing it to get on television. Mm-hmm. So people were doing it because they wanted to be stand-ups. And I think that's changed now. I think a lot of stand-ups want to get on television as soon as they can. And
there's certainly a lot. In the 9 years I've been doing stand-up, it has seemed like a completely valid career path in a way that it didn't even 9 years ago. And even now, I think there's a lot of people. I don't know if you know about the Alternative Comedy Memorial Society. Yeah. And there's kind of a new wave of people who are doing stuff that can deliberately never get on TV. Although we'll find out in 5 years whether any of those people end up on TV.
Well, I think it's important. But I definitely think, it's weird. And I don't want to be slagging off anyone because I think it's hard. But especially with television, some of the comics on television have brought it way back to the way it was in the 70s. Mm. And that's kind of really wrong. And it feels like alternative comedy just wasn't important at all. Besides people... you know, trying not to be kind of homophobic and racist and the rest, which, you know, society isn't as such anymore. That's the only change to the really fairly bog standard jokes on television. And I think this has been a great, very friendly festival. And I think the worst aspect of this whole festival is Dave's stupid kind of joke of the festival, which belittles...
Sure.
Everything everyone's trying to
do. Sure. This is I don't know if people know about this, that Dave, the TV channel, every year publishes their top 10 jokes. And they're often, they're one-liners out of context or tags
jokes.
From people's routines or something. Yeah.
And I find that really belittling and kind of totally disrespectful to what The Fringe is all about.
Mm-hmm. So with just to follow the line then of how you were progressing, you were, because you ended up with your own TV show, obviously, after you won the Perrier. Yeah. Here, so pre-Perrier, or pre that show, that was your first show, was it?
No, I came up to Edinburgh first and did one of those, like, three of us doing one show.
Sure.
And
who was that with? Who
that was with Simon Bligh and Bert Tyler Moore.
Okay, I know Simon, I don't know.
But. Yeah, no, and that was great. Like, I've always loved the festival. And then the second year I came up and did a really weird show at Stephen Frost, where he played my manager. And the whole show was about, we were filming it to sell to ITV.
Okay.
And he was just the most fun to work with on stage. And we were told we'd had a chance of winning the Perrier that year.
Okay.
So, but we were given a nod that everyone loved us. So to be eligible, we had to kind of do five more days. And we weren't selling out at all. We had to went in. So we announced, you know, due to public demand, five extra days. And then we didn't get a nomination or anyone else came to see the shows.
I know,
that was fine.
A lot of new comics listening to this, I'm sure, will take heart from the fact that that sort of thing is, you know, has been going on forever.
Because that's the other weird thing about this festival, because obviously, you know, I can't win the Fosters thing, but all the comics, like, and I was thinking, why don't they announce it midway through the nominations midway, so then it helps boost those good shows?
Sure.
And then they kind of pointed out, the young kids, that, well, then there's a lot of other people who think they might be up for it, and if they're not up for it, then they go, no, fuck, what's the point of the festival?
Yeah,
which is
right.
Not what the festival's about. It's about doing a good show, like, you know, so that's a bit weird. But
just on the subject of the awards, do you kind of, obviously as someone who's won the Perrier in the past, did that make a big difference to you? Are you okay with the idea of winning award? Because it seems from your work and from what you're talking about that you'd be the sort of person who'd kind of turn down an award.
I wouldn't turn it down, but I don't think it's important. I don't really play the game. I won one this year, though, by the show, if you're thinking of coming along tonight. The Herald Angel, they gave one.
Oh, you did. You got a Herald Angel for the show. Okay.
But that's sweet. But I don't think, like, the Foster thing, I went there yesterday because I don't ever go to them. Mm-hmm. But I went because Carl Donnelly's a friend and he was nominated, mm-hmm. and he couldn't be there. So I was going to accept it for him. And it was interesting just watching it because, as I say, I don't go to them and I don't really want to be part of that thing. And I just think, I think Foster's is a ridiculous sponsor for comedy because I just don't. You know, because I tell you, now this is how wanky and middle-aged I am. So I went there and I watched that and went, yeah, I'm very happy for Bridget winning and the other people. And then I walked away and there was a Scottish guy pissed out of his head carrying a 10-pack of Fosters, talking gibberish to his mate, going across a road during a red light, I might add. And he was that pissed that he had the can of Fosters and it fell out of his hand. And, you know, all the frothy stuff came out. Didn't bother picking it up. And all I could see is this image of the can of Fosters there and just going, this isn't what comedy's about. I had that little moment to myself. See, that's when I don't drink anymore. So that's when other people are having fun late at night. I'm having profound moments during the day. Philosophical musings about drunk spilling Fosters. But I don't think it's a good thing. And I just think just watching, because all the comics, like, you shouldn't be putting them into competition. Like, obviously they should be given a leg up. And everyone, every comic, you know, people, this is the weird thing that people don't understand, is that every comedian is insecure, and every day we need a slight ego boost before a show. Like, it's lovely when someone comes up and says, "Saw your show, I really enjoyed it." That means the world to us, no matter where you are in your life. It just, validation is so important. And so it's good in that sense. But just watching that ceremony yesterday, and just watching, like, you know, 12 disappointed people. So it kind of, the maths doesn't work there, that one person's extremely happy and there's a lot of people who are kind of quite sad about the whole thing. And it's also, that room should really be just whoever's giving out the awards and the people who are nominated. But there seems to be a lot of people in this industry now who seem to make a lot of money by simply watching comedy.
I don't think that makes much sense. There's a lot of in kind of peripheral industry things now, I think, about people who work in comedy branding and kind of, like, you know, the force of comedy as a means of... I suppose comedy has always been used to sell beer, because that's kind of a lot of the motivation for pubs putting on gigs in rooms above pubs, is to try and sell beer.
Well, it's a
business, does seem to have spread out in a...
It's naive of me not to think it is a business, because that's what everything is at the end of the day.
So this is Sean. I'm going to let this interview speak for itself, mainly because I'm poorly at the moment, as you can probably hear from my voice, but also because Sean's got a lot to say and I'm going to let him say it. He's been through an extraordinary sort of a renaissance, and from being almost a comedy pop star in my youth, he's refined what he does and what he aims for, and he's making some really interesting comedy that's genuinely about something. So it's fascinating to see his work, very, very funny, and fascinating to think about what he'll come up with next. That is two fascinatings in a row, which means you have to finish your drinks. Do feel free to tweet at ComComPod. Let's use the hashtag CCP drinking. That's ComComPod drinking, with your suggestions for the ComComPod drinking game. There've been some lovely ones on the Facebook group, and over Twitter generally, but let's do those with a hashtag and let's see if we can compile the definitive list. Thank you for listening to the Gary Delaney episode. Thanks for that. Loads of comments. Howard Reed and Tony Cowards on Twitter, both excellent comedians, suggesting that the EP should be destroyed on account of how useful it is. So go back and listen to that before something happens to it. Paul Savage was kind enough to put that one together, the Delaney episode in Wolverhampton, and he promoted that show and sort of did that, just sort of made it all happen, really. And the brilliant Adnam Ahmed in Leicester, he did the same thing with the Nick Helm live ComCom. And I really enjoyed doing it somewhere new. I really like bringing the show to people outside of London or Edinburgh. So if you're a promoter and you'd like me to come and do something similar near you, we can discuss that. Email me info@comedianscomedian.com, and I'm more than happy to talk about sort of visiting you somewhere and doing a live ComCom with a guest that we can decide upon between us. That's everything. Oh, God, I feel dreadful. I'm sorry. This is, what a downer on the episode. Fascinating interview. Three in a row. That's a tequila. Finally, thank you everyone, as ever, for all your donations. Very kind of you. You too can support the show by hitting the PayPal button at ComCom. It's not even ComCom, it's comedianscomedian.com. I'm in a state. Sorry, Sean. Sorry, you, the listener. I'll be fine by the next time I speak to you. Or dead. Now, it's back to Sean Hughes.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So with the show that you brought up, your first, or not your first hour, but the hour that won the award.
Sponsored by Budweiser, I believe.
Sponsored. so that, had that been a show that you had kind of waited for?
Well,
had you waited for the stuff to come for you, or had you kind of written to a
plan? I tell you exactly what
that
happened. I was really frustrated on the circuit. I've never liked club comedy. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't really suit me. And I got into a situation with the clubs I really liked. I said, can I start doing 40-minute sets? Because I feel I could express myself better. Because I like to just mosey on in rather than going, bang, here we go. And they say, yeah. And then they go, well, and they say, well, don't tell anyone else you went well because you don't want anyone else asking for 40-minute sets. And I went, well, I think this could be the way forward. And they weren't having it. And this sounds like bullshit, but I said, no, I'm going to write this show. I'm going to write a one-man show with a theme and a narrative and, like, story, and which hadn't been done in the festival before.
Okay.
Now it's... I started all that shit. Unbelievable.
Really?
Yeah. Like, I'm not the first person I have to tell a story. Don't get me wrong.
Sure, sure.
It sounds arrogant, but it was... That wasn't unheard
of. In terms of, like, an hour of comedy. So people were doing hours, but they were just their club set hours.
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay.
And I just wanted to do it because I really wanted to just abstract comedy. And I quite literally said, if this doesn't work... And it wasn't if it doesn't win the award. Mm. I said, if it doesn't work... Because, like, the day before I went to Edinburgh that year, I did the show at the East Dulwich Tavern, mm-hmm. like, which is a pub, so it was quite hard work, but it fucking died on its ass. And I was getting the train the next day to do the show. And, like, and that's the one, as I say, that won the award. But it was, but if that hadn't worked, I probably would have quit comedy because I just couldn't bear the idea of going back and doing the Comedy Store and Jonglers and stuff. It just didn't suit me. It wasn't what it was
about.
How
does that feel to have pioneered that form of doing something new with comedy? And then, I mean, you've presumably been to a lot of festivals since then, so you've seen people take that and, you know, take it all sorts of different directions.
But as I say, I think I was just a little notch in that. But, like, I'm very happy. But what people tend to do now is some people doesn't suit a narrative, so they feel like everyone has to have a name of a show, which is ridiculous.
Sure.
It shouldn't be the case. It should be just play to your own strengths. And some people are really good. But, like, the thing about the Edinburgh Festival, it is an amazing festival, but people have lost sight of what it's about. And it is about, the reason it's on for a month is not in the hope that every television producer will come to your show because it's on 28 times. It's because you get 28 goes to make a show better every night.
Mm.
And, like, my show from the Wednesday we started on the 29th to tonight, it's the same show, but it's so much better.
Mm.
And that's what I'm taking from the festival.
And where is this festival in the life of this particular show? What happens to it next? Are you touring the show next?
Yeah, well, that's the beginning. So I'll tour it in January, and then it becomes a two-hour show as well.
Okay.
And that's the joy of that. So I put more stand-up into it that way because I don't really have support acts and stuff. So it just grows and grows. And then hopefully some things happen with it. But if it doesn't, it's fine. Because to me, it's always been everything else as a bonus.
Mm-hmm.
And I love doing the show. And that's very important to me. And if I didn't like doing it, I just simply wouldn't do it.
Mm. Is that why you had a big break from stand-up?
Yeah.
From... I can't remember the dates, but you were certainly... I remembered you as a younger person. I remembered seeing Sean's show on TV. I was a big fan of your TV show. And I looked back at it, at some of it yesterday and today as part of kind of prep for the interview. And I was amazed by how much of it seemed... I don't know, it seems more ahead of its time than some stuff being done today. Like in the first episode where you kind of walk out and you're on the phone to someone and you say, oh no, I can just see the pub because you're on a studio set. Obviously the studio...
We were given, that was all based on the Perrier winning show, but we were just, like, again, unheard of now, but we were given absolute freedom. They gave us a load of money, so the budget, we could do what we wanted.
And who was us at that time? Who were you making it with? Is this you and a production company?
Yeah, it was a production company that came on board straight away, and it was just beautiful. They just went, I'd go in and leave the script in every week,
mm-hmm.
and they'd had very little qualms about it. And then pretty much then when we got to filming... We'd film on a Friday and we'd start on the Monday rehearsal, and then I'd got that week to really kind of... Because, like, in any script that you write, you always... There's just bridges where you go, that's rubbish, but I'll eventually get rid of that. But that that gets me to there.
And were you writing all of that sort of in a room on your own, or were you writing it with associates?
No, I wrote it with one of the... A guy who had helped me a little bit with the live show, I brought him on board for the first series, and then I realised I don't like working with other people. Because I'm much better on my own. But, so I brought him in initially just to help me out, and then I wrote the second series on my own.
Okay. So what we were talking about was the gap. So after the TV show, and then you were on Nevermind the Buzzcocks, and you were very sort of present as a stand-up comedian.
Yeah, well, what happened was I did two series of Sean's show, and I loved doing that, but then I started touring, and the tours were full of 14-year-old girls.
Mm.
And God love them for coming. I really appreciate it. But that's not why I do stand-up comedy. And quite literally, the autograph sessions were taking longer than the shows afterwards.
Okay.
So I said, I'm not doing any more of that, which was kind of brave because I wanted another series.
Sure.
But it just so I pulled away. And then I went to quite a, I kind of bounced off that and went to a very dark place and started writing much darker comedy.
Okay. And it's sort of partially to make sure that 14-year-old girls wouldn't enjoy it. Do you mean to kind of break out of being the...
I hope that I wasn't kind of going, well, what can I do to annoy 14-year-old girls?
Sure, but do you see what I mean? In terms of the audience you were attracting wasn't necessarily in key with what you actually wanted to be saying.
Yeah, and that's absolutely the case. But and it just like, in essence, it's a bit of a weird thing because I like even yesterday I met a guy and he just came up to me and he says, you were such an important part of my childhood, you know? And I know how important that show was for certain people. It was always just culture. It wasn't mainstream. And so I'm very, like, that is my legacy at the moment, and I'm very happy with that. And then, as I said, I did that, and then, like, I was doing big tours, and I was never really into doing the big things. I'm very much about smaller audience. And then I started doing more profound comedy, and then I realised, I think I was wrong, but I started writing novels, and I felt I could get much bigger ideas across with those. So I felt with comedy, you do have that kind of restraint that you do have to make people laugh every 30 seconds, and that's right as well. And I felt that right quite restraining for me, so I just went... I felt, and rightly so, I felt I couldn't do any more in that thing. Like, I'd outlived all my life experiences. I've written all about it, and I think it's a good idea. And so I took 7 years off.
Okay. So I think I've certainly experienced a small bit of that myself, and I know other comics who have, that you feel like you've given everything to comedy because you're, particularly if you're coming to Edinburgh every year, you're right, the demand of writing a new hour, to get a good new hour, you've got to write more than 1 hour. So you use up, you start to sort of dredge everything in your life and mine everything that's happening to you. 7 years seems like quite a long break. I think people normally, from what I imagine, is that people kind of go, I'll have a year off.
It wasn't going to be a break, I wasn't going to do it again.
Okay. How did that feel to make that decision of going, that's it?
It felt good at the time because I felt slightly... Well, yeah, I was kind of in a bit of a goldfish bowl, but I felt, I'd had that. I'd done that.
Now. How do you mean a goldfish bowl? Because of your success, do you mean?
Well, because with celebrity, I guess, where, you know, people were always on your back about various different things. And you kind of led astray as well in many ways.
Okay. How do you mean?
But, you know, just doing bad things like drugs and stuff like that.
Sure. And that wasn't as... I mean, when you say you were led astray, do you find... Like, I know a lot of comedians kind of enthuse about that lifestyle of, like, that kind of crazy, I can do whatever I want, and...
Yeah, but I probably did for a while, but, you know, you look back on that with terrible sadness. It was very immature and very shallow. And, like, it's like, even today, like, you know, I try to explain to young comics that, especially the ones who get really trashed after a show, like, and I'm not, like, I don't drink, but I'm not Puritan. I think drinking's brilliant. I really do. I just drank too much. I perceive myself as someone who still drinks, but I drank all mine. You know,
Just
drank it really quickly in my life. And so I'm never going to have a go at people for doing that. But it's just that, and I just, like, you only learn from your own experience. And I just think comics don't know the absolute gift they're given of being able to come into an audience and making that audience laugh. That's your buzz. And then to watch them destroy it over the next 3 hours by getting trashed, it's just a ridiculous thing, you know? And they're trying to chase that natural high. And it has to be a natural high, like, you know? And, you know, I kind of... At my age, I realised that doing the show is the amazing drug.
Sure.
And
sure.
Even if it's like if it doesn't go to the way you want it, it's still an amazing drug, like, you know? And it's kind of life affirming either way you do it.
So having walked away from stand up, and then did you say earlier on that you thought the writing the books, something about that was wrong. You thought that it would turn out to be a mistake.
That it would
replace stand up.
No, it was kind of I thought it was probably a mistake thinking I'd quit forever because I'm a stand-up comedian and it's the only place I feel comfortable in my life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's a sadness for me, really, but that's the way it is. And so I don't know how I could even contemplate not doing that. But it's but the novels, I loved it because you could just... That helped, you know, craft a narrative as well. I really enjoy. And it's also, like, it wasn't one of those things of, again... I find that a bit odd. What you were saying to as well about comics, they should take a year off Edinburgh rather than kind of try and doing mm-hmm. a shitty hour about something that doesn't mean anything to them. And with novels, I wrote two novels because there were two stories I desperately wanted to get out of my head, and they were important to me as well. So, and then after that, I went, well, there's nothing else I really want to write about. You know, like these sure. authors who write a book a year, and you just go, yeah. well, that's a bit shit doing that.
Okay. Why is that? Because it just feels like the Edinburgh thing of just trying to chuck stuff together for the sake of it.
Yeah, then you're using a skill set, but to say absolutely nothing. And I think, you know, you kind of... Like, weirdly, Alexei Sale, who's doing his stuff again, he did an expression in his show, which is, like, one of the best expressions I've ever heard in my life. And he talks about how he shouldn't have came back because he's diluting the legacy.
Yes.
And it's become one of my favorite phrases. And yes. like, you know, it's just an amazing phrase because
I think he says in the show that his wife, I think yeah. he puts that in the yeah. mouth of his wife and yeah. says that she's telling him not to risk doing that.
That yeah. should be up there with quotes of quotes yeah. because as we get older, all we are doing is diluting the legacy. And not comics, it's everyone in this room because, you know, you start, you know, whatever you do, like, because the aging process, even when you're playing football and you are a great footballer and you play football in the park, you're diluting the legacy.
Sure, okay.
And everything you do, in a sense, is diluting the legacy. So that just keeps on popping into my head all the time. And, you know, you wonder if you're diluting your own legacy, really.
You mentioned sadness there, Ben. You said it was a sadness that the stage was the only place you yeah. felt happy. Do you think that sadness or some element of melancholy kind of permeates your work, even though it's funny?
I don't think so, but you know, but I don't think like that. You know, I just get on with it.
Okay,
but it's
The reason I'm proposing it is I saw your show on a night when I think the previous night I'd seen Jason Byrne's show.
Right,
and obviously his show is yeah. just lunatic frenzy sure. of energy and improvisation and joy. And I thought to myself, I think what I'm seeing here is like a happy man being happy.
Yeah.
You know, separate to the funnies involved, separate to the laughs. And I wondered if when I was seeing yours, I don't mean this to sound like a criticism.
Sad man being sad.
Well, it was a melancholy show. There was a story in your show yeah. about being picked up by a pervert in a car on the way yeah. home. I, you know, went.
Yeah, but I like it's the thing of it's an Irish thing. We're not frightened to show our emotions, which British people do seem to be scared of that much more than us. And I don't see it as sadness at all. I'm very content. And but what I'm probably doing is, because the last show I did last year was about my father dying, which, again, melancholic subject, but a very uplifting show. Mm-hmm. But and this show, that made me more evocative of my childhood. So I think what I'm trying to do is help people make sense of their lives by talking about bad things that happened in your childhood. But it's not a sad show in the slightest.
Sure. No, I mean, I wasn't crying during it, but I think what I'm trying to say
thanks.
Is that lowest bit of the legacy. I think what I'm trying to say is that it had the sense of you wrestling with something. A lot of it was about the, you know, the bad advice given to you by parents and teachers and priests. And I just wondered whether there was something in that show whereby you say it and you get it out through comedy and then you don't need to think about it anymore.
No. It's not therapy.
Okay.
In the slightest. But no, I just think, but then I haven't done a good job with you in the audience because it is to try and make you feel better about yourself because bad things happen to us all. And I think, you know, you can only kind of write about what you know as well. But as I say, the main thing in that show is to let you know that it's okay if things don't go great for you. It doesn't make you. And it's all about being together, like, you know, because like it's quite abstract in the show where the old pub joke, a character from a joke comes into sure. my life and things like that. But it's some of the reviews have been saying it's a really intense show and it's not in the slightest. Like, it's really mentally and physically kind of exhausting for me because it really takes it out and it's a real powerhouse of a performance. It's very energetic, but but there's no sadness there whatsoever. And the thing is, like, you know, I use children's clothes to show emotion, but the hardship and the hardship of when romance breaks up, but that's to make people, again, feel better about it. Because we've all been in broken relationships.
Sure, but even though the outcome is that we feel better, the means that you're using, do you not think that's poignant when you've got children's clothes on a rack and you're talking? And it's funny
yeah.
because you're talking about, oh, there's this girl and I fancy this girl and this is me and that's the other guy. But it is kind of it is kind of poignant, do you not think?
Well, poignant, yeah, but I wouldn't say sad. You know, I think it's like, but see, this is the other thing I do in the stand-up set at the moment is, like, it's weird how we pretty much an audience gathers together as a community, and that's what you are for the moment. And we always do that to laugh, and I don't understand why people don't do that to cry, you know, some more, because comedy is so close to kind of laughing is so close to crying. It's unbelievable. It's pretty much the same muscle that you're using. And all I, like, again, it goes back to, like, yeah, if you're doing a 20-minute set, just keep the chuckles going. But an hour, you want to take people on, you know, I hate saying the word fucking roller coaster. But you do want the whole gamut of emotions, like, you know, and you want the ups and downs. Because what tends to happen is in an hour set, where people haven't got live experience, they do really funny stuff at the start, and then they do a meandering story, mm-hmm. and then do another bit of funny bit at night. And I tend to like try to kind of bring real life into it and bring that narrative in. So you've got little resting points in the show, but not where you're kind of doing duffer material. You're just doing slightly more profound. That's my thinking, my logic behind it. You know, people might just go, no, that was quite a meandering story in the middle of yours as well, Sean.
Sure.
But that's where I'm coming from, rather than like, because like in any hour show, there's that 40-minute dip as well.
Mm-hmm. So something I see in a lot, I think something most people probably see in a lot of shows once they've seen enough Edinburgh shows is that there is a sense of there are formulas. It's something previous guests have talked about on the show, on this show, about how you can, you know, if a sad thing happens at 45 minutes and then, you know, there's almost a formula. Did you, in your current show, with the amount of, you know, the sort of Edith Piaf, you're wearing a dress at the beginning, you've got a guy on stage trying to fit a shape into a child's play shape set. Those elements, is that like a conscious effort to break the formula of just being a man telling stand-up? Or is it just that all avenues are open to you?
Yeah, it's more all avenues. What I tend to do with the bigger ideas is let them really permanent and ferment in my brain for about a year. So I kind of knew I wanted to use children's clothes to be evocative of childhood and use drama that way.
Mm.
And then I knew the building blocks was such a big part of everyone's childhood. So we built that. And then we got a machine, a buzz machine that says fail.
Mm-hmm.
So let people kind of be interested in that. So those ideas, that's not like, oh, I've written 40 minutes, let's have we flesh this out. Those ideas were in my head way beforehand. Sure. Like, ridiculously, I know that my next show, the only thing I know about it is I'll be wearing a black suit.
Okay.
And that's there, and I don't know why, but I will be wearing a black suit, and that's all I know about the next show.
Okay.
So I'd book tickets for that straight away. Sounds like a good one, doesn't it?
Easy PR angle, classic. Do you find when you're doing... I want to talk a bit about your audience and how your audience has developed, because if you're doing work now that is... Is it more challenging to do stuff with, you know, in a dress at the beginning and with the, you know, with children's clothes on, say, a Friday or a Saturday night here at the festival?
Yeah,
do you find that people come in that aren't expecting that sort of a show?
Yeah, they're the hardest nights, is the weekend. But having said that, yesterday's audience were the best we've had for the whole festival.
And what was it about them when you say the best?
Well, because they went, for the second I walked on, they just went for it, and then we went on the journey together. And that's what I mean. When it works, it's a real proper journey that we go on. And see, it's that weird thing as well, because I've always loved callbacks before. There were kind of every fucker does them now.
Yeah, yeah.
But now, like,
this just to explain for the people in the room that might not know the terminology.
Everyone has been to one comedy show knows.
Does everyone hands up if you don't know what a callback is? There'd be at least a few. So it's reincorporating something that you mentioned earlier on.
Yeah, and then basically a lot of the time you're laughing because you're remembering it happened earlier on. It's quite a cheap device. But everyone used them, including me. And but now, because I remember a comic came up to me and says, "Oh, I love all your callbacks in your show." And they're not callbacks. They're like, because I do use callbacks, but they're not like I do bring things back, but they're to make sense of the show
rather than being some arbitrary kind of technique layered on at the end.
Yeah, because like I think one of the beautiful moments is when I talk about accident with the virginity, you know, and that's. And that's just talking about a philosophy, really. I know that makes no sense if you don't see the show, but if you don't see the show...
So when you talk about the philosophy, or jokes as philosophy, is that the most important thing to you in the show? What, like, in terms of what drives you to do the show? Is it wrangling that philosophy that's the most important?
Yeah, philosophy is probably too highfalutin, but it is to get ideas across. Like, and also, you kind of, you find out... like, I didn't realise till way into the doing the show that I was really upset that society tells us how to behave, and we, like sheep, tend to do that. And that became quite a big part of the show. And that's kind of, that makes, gives me such joy when that part of the show, when I tell people it's okay not to do those things. And I love, like, I just, like, and it's not really, you know, ideas above my station, but I hope people go out of my show and then they have some new ideas. Like, you know, but not to even agree with, but just go, all right, I hadn't thought about that. And that's all, that's all I pretty much, well, I think all good comedy does that, doesn't it? It's not just about laughing. You do go out going, all right, wow, that's a weird way of looking at things.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping. Otherwise, I've been doing it wrong for such a long time.
But would it feel like doing it wrong? I mean, given that you're successful, you're a successful professional comedian. Do you feel like you're where you want to be? Do you feel as successful as you want to be?
Well, yeah, because, like, so when I was just talking to, it's lovely. The thing I love about Edinburgh is it's a bit like living in a creative neighbourhood. I don't hang out with comics, but I love seeing them in the street and having that five-minute chat. But and you meet some old heads, and it's just, like, I'm doing that. Like, as I say, I'm not up for a Foster's Award, so I'm not kind of going, and I'm not looking at the reviews every day. I'm doing it to be to a good show, so I'm, of course I'm doing it for that reason. Because it's really important to me to do the show, and so I'm where I'm at. But, like, you have to remember as well, going back to what I said beforehand, when we started doing it, I've never had a career. Just things have happened. I've never went, oh, and then I'm going to do this and do that. But, you know, everything else is a bonus, and I am a stand-up, and I kind of lost my way a little bit. But that's what I am.
In terms of finding your way back after you lost your way, was it scary to come back on a stand-up stage having not done it for 7 years?
No.
But it's so much a part of your bones that
Yeah, the first show I did back, I just went, oh, this feels really good.
Yeah.
But then very quickly, like, that felt really good. And then I did a DVD, and that was a really good show. But then, I went, well, I've run out of things to say. And kind of, because I wish I was one of those comics I could play to any room. But if you put me in a room of students, they would murder me because I've nothing to say to those people, like, you know. So, and that's a fault of mine that I can't go across all that. But I'm kind of more interested in talking to my generation about stuff as well. So my generation is, you know, like, because that's the thing, like, once you realise that you're not a hipster, and that's very kind of, that's very liberating.
Okay, and why is that?
Well, because I'm still in my head 12, and, you know, I don't have that many mirrors. So, and then I'm looking at it, saying, what the fuck are those fucking 50-year-old people doing? I'm like, oh, they're my age.
Yeah.
You know, of course, that's why they're there. And, like, when I see, like, 8-year-olds in the audience, I get double joy because I love being able to, because I think they see me as kind of slightly rebellious. But it's also because my mother would never dream of going to see a show, and she's 75. Not my show, but she wouldn't dream of, you know, very seldom leaves the house. So when I see someone who's 80 proactively going out, it just fills me so full of warmth that people are living proper lives, you know, just real joy in my heart.
I'd like to give the opportunity for the audience to ask some questions, if you'd like to. What normally happens is that when I say that, everyone goes, oh, I didn't realise we had to be involved. So I'll ask another question and give you a minute to think of some if you'd like to ask anything. I wanted to ask about just your advice, really, on writing, on creating, to either a newer comic or someone who's been going, say, as long as I have. Are there any sort of principles that you try to write to?
No, but I think, like, in essence, just that word principle. You should have principles, and then you should stick to those principles, regardless of, you know, whatever they are. That's what you should stick to. But nobody should be telling you what to do. I'm a really anti comedy creative teaching classes. I don't like that. I think you should find those things out yourself over a longer period of time. So I'm anti all that. But I just think it's just a matter of, like, trying to find your own voice, which sometimes you'll find you haven't got the capability of doing. And other times it might take forever. Like, I think the best example to anyone who's thinking of, who wants to be a really good stand-up, is Mickey Flanagan, who, you know, I'm so delighted he's, you know, I don't know if he's having fun playing the stadiums, I can't imagine, but I'm so delighted for his success, because he's just someone who stuck to his guns and had his voice and just, you know, chipped and chipped away. And he's a perfect example of someone who works hard and is true to himself.
Are there elements of stand-up that you want to attain that you think are currently not in your grasp? Are there things that you see people do that you go, I wish I could do that as well as that person.
Yeah, I wish I didn't mumble and take 20 minutes to probably say what a really good comic could do in 5.
Okay. Would you rather I mean, I think the comics that can say stuff in 5 minutes, that's like a process of word economy and kind of writing like that.
Yeah, there's club comics, and then there's people who express themselves in that sense. And the club comics can do that as well, but club comics, that's a brilliant skill, which I've never been that great at. But it's like, I tend to get, I do the occasional soft gig on a circuit, and you always get the promoter going, yeah. You really love yourself. It always takes 15 minutes for the audience to really get into it. And it's one of those things that once I get the audience with my rhythm, then they want me forever.
Mm.
But, you know, I'm not one of those, wham, hey, how you doing? So I find it really hard in that sense. So, but I don't want to learn that. I just want to be as natural as possible. You know, because that's the other thing. Like, I just had bumped into a comic just beforehand, and he says, oh, yeah, people are saying they love your show, the way you just basically have a chat with the audience. I fucking don't have a chat with anyone. This is very hard thought out philosophies. I'm not having a fucking chat with the audience. They're going, hey, yeah, 14 quid, and going, how are you? Nice cup of tea. But yeah, so, but it is that thing. I take it as a huge compliment, because, as I say, it harks back to looking at Richard Pryor and making him look so easy when
making
he sees
it look
him
casual.
Just chatting. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's like, it takes a lot of hard work.
Can we, we've got about sort of 5 minutes. We could have a question from the audience if anyone wanted to ask one. What do you think you're...
We died in one gig. It was hardly flopping.
if your double act in London, if you had gone back to Ireland as well, what do you think you would have ended up doing? Would you have...
Well, that's the thing. Like, life is brilliant like that. That's nothing to do with comedy. Like, you know, weirdly, your life can take weird different paths. But the strange thing is, I haven't heard from that guy since, and that was 25 years ago. He tweeted me last week with a picture of the two of us, which kind of gave me the creeps a little bit, like, you know. Just saying, I saw this and I saw you on Twitter. But, yeah, no.
Why would that give you the creeps?
Because I quite literally...
Oh, because you literally had no contact whatsoever.
My sister's ill. I felt like sending the tweet. I felt like going, how's your sister?
Yeah.
But he would have went, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
You know? But, yeah, no, but I think that's why I think life's such a beautiful gift, because it will, like, weirdly, just tiny little things can change your life completely. So I wouldn't, it would have been totally different, but I wouldn't know in what way that would have happened. But I think kind of, that's a little bit creepy as well, isn't it? Like, you go, oh, you know, be careful what you do, but just live your life and kind of try, as I say, be true to yourself, and then you tend to make the right decisions along the way.
Just to digress onto Twitter for a minute, do you engage with your audience? Do you engage with, I mean, do you hang around after gigs? Do people come up to you, talk to you in bars? Are you happier just disappearing?
Yeah, well, I'm happy to talk to anyone in the right circumstances, but I'm also mature enough to realise that my relationship with the audience is on stage, and then that's all it is.
Mm.
And that comes to you really the hard way, because, like, and every comic would tell you this, where I think it was in Norwich, where I played a gig to like 600 people or something, and really feeling good about myself. And I just went into the bar, and everyone had gone home. Why is nobody here to see me? And with that sadness, when you end up going back to the hotel with your tour manager and stuff, and having a few beers, and just going, that takes a while to get used to that. They don't want to know. They don't want to have a drink with you. That's it. You made them laugh and just go home. So, like, as I say, it's lovely to get validation, but I don't tend to engage with people. I don't wait outside, and I don't hang out afterwards.
Is it harder now that you don't drink? Is it harder to cope with the come down after a gig?
I don't see a come down. It's just natural.
Well, like you were saying about going, you know, going back and having a few pints with your tour manager. If you can't now have a few pints.
Well, no, I kind of, as I say, because I'm aware that the show was the buzz, and so then you just get on with it, really. Like, I kind of go, like anyone, you just get a little bit tired. I'm tired for about a half hour afterwards, I just disengage. But then after that, I'm absolutely fine. And what I love is, and I think a lot of comics, I like a routine. Like, you've really, tonight's show could be really shit, and I'll blame you. Because I tend to do the exact same thing before a show.
Okay.
And this is really cut into that.
Yeah, absolutely. I've spoiled you.
And like, I go to the same place after the show for coffee, and then I pretty much don't hang out. But yeah, I kind of... And also, Like, like, this sounds ridiculous, but I'm missing my 5-minute power nap this afternoon because of this. And so that could really affect the show because I really do need that 5 minutes.
A really good night to see Sean tonight, to see how he functions without the power nap. We've probably got time for one more question. Great question. What happens to the old comedians and how long will you go on?
they're all in that room waiting to be interviewed. I don't tend to look too far ahead. I think that would destroy every fabric of your being. But, luckily, but I've always had myself down for maybe dying mid-60s. So, but it's a stressful life. So, and you, like, one of the saddest moments of touring the last 3 years was I did a gig in, is it Tewkesbury, where Eric Morecambe died.
I didn't know that.
Do you know that theatre? Is it the Rose? Yeah, and it's a very sweet theatre, but it's a tiny theatre, and the thing is like you probably guess, but every dressing room and every theatre is shit, and it's really depressing, and it's a horrible place to be, and because you're obviously filled with slight anxiety as well. And Eric Morecambe was one of my heroes, and just the fact that he didn't actually die there, he had a heart attack in the dressing room, and then was rushed to hospital, but he died on the way, and I just went, oh God, he died in this. He practically, started his death in this room. And I found that so offensive that such a genius went in such a horrible circumstance like that. But my point is, comics do tend, because of the stress, not to live to... Bob Hope was just that weirdo who lived forever, but everyone else, So you want to start getting on with it, because you're dead in your mid-60s as well.
So when I said earlier on about there being a pervasive sadness or a bleakness to your work, and you went, no, there isn't, it's funny.
But absolutely, because I don't see that as a sadness. I take that on board, that I've accepted that'll be my fate. And I don't mind dying in my I did pensions in earlier age for tax reasons, and I said I'd like them to come when I'm 50, please, because I was very much aware of that. I wasn't going to go, I'll take them out at 70. I'll be fucking way gone.
So are you concerned about... where did I read this? Stuart Lee quoted someone else saying, it might have been Harry Hill, about being asked what their ambition was, and they said their ambition was not to die alone in rented accommodation.
That would be a big one, but I'm not frightened of dying. So the circumstance doesn't matter. But as I say, I just found it sad that someone like Eric Morecambe went in a really... in a provisional... theatre, provincial, not provisional, it sounds like the IRA. provincial theatre. It's just that nonsense as well. I remember as a child watching Tommy Cooper die, in that show. And I knew, because when they were dragging him in, I said, even then I had comedy bones. I went, that's not part of the routine. Mm. He's not well there. And people saying, oh, Tommy Cooper, that's the way he would have liked to have gone. There's no fucking way. He wanted to die in the middle of a routine. If anything, he'd like to be with his friends and family around a bed, not in a kind of being drugged into a horrible dressing room in the Palladium with Jimmy Tarbuck going, yeah, nice. that's no way to go, is it? So that's that nonsense about dying. That's how we'd like to die, making people laugh. That's terrible, terribly trite nonsense.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's all we've got time for. Would you please join me in thanking Mr. Sean Hughes?
Thanks very much. Cheers.
So that was Sean. Many thanks to him for coming along. And you can go to seanhughes.co.uk for details of the current tour of Penguins, which is all over the country this month. I think the last week of March, he's mostly in London. I think he's at the Tricycle. And it finishes at the end of March, so get in quick. seanhughes.co.uk. And if you missed his previous tour, The Right Side of Wrong, that is available, wouldn't you know it, on audible.co.uk/cc. And that's that little, it's not a backslash, it's a forward slash, sorry again. audible.co.uk/cc. Let's take the direction out of it and make things easier. If you go to audible.co.uk/cc, then when you get your free trial for Audible, that also helps support the show. They chuck me a pound or something. I've no idea what the actual money is. I can't think it's much more than that. But if you're going to join Audible anyway, and why not? If you're doing lots of driving, traveling, If you're a comedian and you travel a lot, or if I seem to be meeting lots of illustrators at the moment, hello to all you I've met in the last few weeks, who listen to the show during the day because they can, because they're working visually. So any of you, gang, get yourself along to Audible, and why not try Sean Hughes, The Right Side of Wrong, as your free download when you go to that /CC thing. Thank you, everybody. God, I'm going to crawl away to bed now. Thanks to Pete Jones. Thanks to James Lowy. Thanks to Ben Lund-Conlon for his help as well. This episode was co-produced by Nathan Wood. And if I get round to it, and I think we will, if I and Pete Jones get round to it, we're going to put up 10 minutes of highlights from this online. That may not be up there the day that this comes out, because I'm struggling a bit, but I'm going to bang it up there. So have a look at that. That's youtube.com/comcompod. That's everything. I'm done. Speak to you soon.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
Well, something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional unprofessional, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.